Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the Six-Day War of 1967 led to Israel capturing and occupying additional territory. How might this occupation be challenging the nation's commitments to democracy and human rights? How might it challenge Israeli and Jewish identities? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The recent violence in the occupied territories has raised significant questions as to the impact on Israel as a nation and the Israelis as a people. Founded as a democracy in the aftermath of genocide, Israel's commitment to democratic norms and human rights has been a part of its identity. But the continued occupation of territory seized in the 1967 Six Days War and the discriminatory treatment of its Arab population, largely in the name of security, is challenging this identity. What does the continued occupation and these policies of discrimination mean for the Israeli people, the Jewish people, and the identities of both? Our panel are all area specialists in Jewish studies. They are Mira Sukharov, professor of political science and university chair of teaching innovation in the Department of Political Science at Carleton University. She's the author of International Self, Psychoanalysis in the Search for Israeli-Palestinian Peace, and the co-editor of Social Justice in Israel-Palestine, Foundational and Contemporary Debates. Brent Sasley is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas Arlington. He's the author of Politics in Israel, Governing a Complex Society, and The End of Oslo and the Second Intifada, 2000 to 2005. And Joshua Shanes is Associate Professor of Jewish Studies and Director of the Arnold Center for Israel Studies at the College of Charleston. He's the author of Diaspora Nationalism and Jewish Identity in Habsburg Galicia. He's also the co-author of We Need a Better Definition of Anti-Semitism. Thank you all for joining us. Mira Sukharov, we'll start with you. Since we're talking about the challenges to Israeli and or Jewish identity that the occupation and the current policies vis-a-vis the Palestinians have. What is that identity? Could you describe what Israeli identity is?
Well, I liked how you put it at first regarding Israel seeing itself one way, but not always acting in accordance with its self-perception. And we saw this tension come into play a lot throughout the 1980s. This was what I wrote about in the book you mentioned in the intro, when Israel was fighting the Lebanon War, a very controversial war in 1982, the Israel-PLO war in Lebanon. And many observers likened this to Israel's Vietnam moment. And then the First Intifada, where it was mostly unarmed protesters, many women and children throwing stones against Israeli guns and tanks, and Israelis really grappled with this sense of self that are we becoming an aggressor nation? We see ourselves as fighting wars of no choice. We see ourselves as using purity of arms, and here we're acting in ways that are much more aggressive. And this was a debate from within Israel. And I argued that led Israel to extending an olive branch to the PLO. But I don't think that same dynamic and reckoning is happening now, because I think what Israel and its leadership has succeeded in doing for the most part is casting Hamas and, by extension, not so much in this current month, but oftentimes Iran, as seeking the fundamental annihilation of the country and the people. And when Israel talks about Hamas in that way, the Israeli government and often many segments of the population and commentators are able to push aside the human rights crisis that you talked about, Doug, in your intro. They're able to push aside the ongoing occupation of the West Bank, the ongoing siege of Gaza, and the ongoing inequality between Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel.
Now, Brent Sasley, also, Israel is founded, at least in part, out of the insecurity of the Jewish people. It's obviously not coincidental how soon after the genocide of the Second World War leads to the founding of Israel. So how much of Israeli identity is defined by security and insecurity?
I would say that security issues are paramount in the founding of Israel, but it's not security in the way we might traditionally understand it, fear of threat from invasion. It's security rooted in these traumatic memories of centuries of Jewish persecution, everything from the exile that stemmed after the Roman conquest of the ancient Jewish kingdoms through the Middle Ages, the Spanish Inquisition, culminating in the Holocaust. And so when Zionism was first created in the 1880s, I mean, there were several forces converging and they had a set of different ideas, but a lot of them were oriented around this fact that the only way to keep safe from anti-Semitism, to be a normal nation, to be secure, was to have their own state, just like all these other ethno-nationalities that were creating their own state in that same time period in the 18th century, 19th century, 20th century. And so that sense of security or insecurity is rooted in the country's foundation. It's important to point out, and this gets to Mira's point also, that the Israeli leaders, and I don't just mean political leaders, I mean security leaders, cultural leaders, and so on, they've played up that the importance of that insecurity over the years, but we've seen that especially since the dominance of the political right that began in 2009. And so if you look at the public statements and private statements, but public statements of leaders on the right, there's always these references to Iran, you know, seeking the complete destruction of Israel. Israel's enemies always want to continue to drive it into the sea, which is language that's evocative of the 1940s, 1950s. And Netanyahu himself, who has been prime minister since 2009, regularly refers to these kinds of things. Another Holocaust is about to be perpetrated, that the Jews are never safe, and so on and so on. So I don't think you can understand Israeli politics or Israeli policies without understanding that. But it's important to clarify that the political right has taken this to a new level over the last several years.
And Joshua Shaines, I know you've done quite a bit of work broadly on anti-Semitism, and this desire, this demand for security, certainly has to at least be partially driven by the centuries of anti-Semitism, centuries of hatred directed towards the Jewish people. How much of that protection against this historic hatred of the Jewish people defines Israel?
Thanks. That's a great question. And I agree with everything that's been said till now, although I would take a different angle on it. In my own work, I study contemporary anti-Semitism, but I actually began my work, my first book is on the birth of Zionism. And I would argue the way I understand Zionism by looking at the sources in the 1880s, 90s, 1900s, all the way till today, I tend to see Zionism along with the other nationalisms, as Brent mentioned. In other words, a form of reconstructing identity. You know, when Jews leave the shtetl, as it were, enter the modern world, either physically or metaphorically, become modern people, like all the other peasants and other people who are urbanizing and changing in a new secular environment, they have to reconstruct their identity. And what Zionism is, above all else, is sort of a range of new kinds of identities for Jews in this new modern world, one that's based on the concept that Jews constitute a nation. And that was one that they had to struggle to convince Jews to accept. It took them decades, just like it took other Ukrainian and Polish intellectuals, Palestinian intellectuals, and others to convince the people to think of themselves this way. So I think in many ways, most Zionists didn't intend to form a state, didn't intend to go to Palestine any more than Zionists in America today intend to move to Israel. But rather, it sort of gives them a grounding of what it means to be a Jew in the modern world when they're trying to figure that out. And I think to a certain extent, that continues to be the case to this day. Anti-Semitism is part of that. There's no doubt about it. But I think to a large extent, what Zionism gives people is a kind of denomination of Jewishness, a kind of way of understanding what it means to be a Jew. And I would say in the last 20, 30, 40 years, what it's become is almost a kind of Israelism. It's now that there is an Israel, now that Zionism is based in sort of connecting to the country of Israel, it becomes a kind of Israelism, that connecting to Israel, celebrating Israel, Israel Independence Day, and these sorts of things, Israeli dance and music, that's become a kind of surrogate Jewishness or Judaism for many people. And I think these things need to be remembered, because when we look at Israel itself, certainly the right wing, as Brent mentioned, is very much playing up fear of Iran, fear of the next annihilation around the corner. But they're also playing up the connections to the land and redeeming the land. And the land is ours and it beckons to us and we're going to settle it and so on in ways that sometimes contradict security interests and certainly in any event are distinct from security interests. I would want to keep that balance in mind.
And Brent Sessler, I have a response to that.
I think it's really interesting to think about what he just said, this emphasis on Israel. And we could talk about the role or the presumed role of Israel in diaspora Jewish identity. But another key element of Jewish identity is the Holocaust and you know, Jewish education, Jewish communal organizations, including synagogues and temples, they all emphasize the Holocaust and remembering the Holocaust. And so you have these twin pillars. There's the Holocaust, which is this extreme moment of insecurity because of the trauma that was visited, the murder, the torture, the experimentation on the Jewish people. And so it's this traumatic humiliation. And on the other side, you have this moment of elation and triumph, which is the founding of the Jewish state and all the accomplishments that it's made over the course of the years, including its victories against, you know, this massive Arab enemy, which is, I'm using language that it's commonly used. And so it's not a surprise in that sense that Jewish communities around the world would want to celebrate Israel because it can help them deal more effectively with the trauma of the Holocaust if they have something that they can show that they can be proud of instead of something that they can, that might be fearful or that they might be ashamed of or they might still be traumatized by.
Amir Sukharov, your response?
Since we're on the Holocaust, it didn't take us long to get there. I agree with what Brent was just saying, and I wanted to highlight another real big tension in Israel's founding. Arguably, as scholars have shown, there was a real rejection of the victim mentality that is early Israeli leaders perceived to be embodied in the Holocaust. So even army slang had very offensive terms like calling one another a soap. The idea that that's what the fate of Jews who perished in the Nazi death camps, and the idea that Holocaust victims were like sheep who went to the slaughter. And so there was this idea of a really intense sense of self-reliance in Israel, that Israel would forge a new reimagined identity in contrast to the Holocaust identity. So there was a lot of victim blaming going on. And so in a sense, on one hand, it seemed like identity of early Israel was a very harsh break with the Holocaust. But as we go deeper, and I would say that it took me a while, I think, personally, to realize that there was a lot more going on. And I think someone like Ian Lustig and his new book, which is really valuable, we can discuss the arguments he makes in it later, called Paradigm Lost. But one thing he says in his book is that Israelis are really under a spell of trauma, and he calls that holocaustia. It's a word he creates to describe it. And that holocaustia, that sense of Holocaust intergenerational trauma, he argues, has, I guess, clouded or at least shaped Israel's approach to the Palestinians and given it a siege mentality that the actual threat, whatever it is, given Palestinians' very, very limited actual power, is magnified in the eyes of Israelis. So on one hand, the Holocaust forms a moment of a huge break as Israel creates its identity. On the other hand, the shadow of that trauma looms large.
Mira, actually, I'd like to come back to you with a follow-up with what you're saying here. And that's you know, the impact of the Holocaust on the, you know, the genocide on the military within Israel. One thing that I've noticed as an outside observer is just how much Israeli policy is driven by a need to respond militarily to any acts of violence. Is it fair to say that that need, that specific policy that they've adopted really comes out of the same spirit of what you were just discussing?
I mean, certainly there's a large attempt by the Israeli government via the military to showcase its ability. And the Israeli government, and specifically Netanyahu, in the last few weeks, we hear a word that isn't quite used correctly, security discourse, but you'll hear the word a lot coming from Netanyahu, deterrence, that what he's doing is deterrence. And you know, and other IR scholars know that really what they're doing is compellence. They're actually using force. Once force is used, deterrence has failed. Deterrence is the threat of unacceptable punishment. And that's what Netanyahu thinks he's doing when he's pummeling Gaza and resulting in the killing of scores of Palestinians, including children, hundreds really. So I think there is a real attempt to show the world that Israel is strong. But again, this also comes with a tension because early on in Israel's military doctrine, they talked about fighting only wars of no alternative. Only when they were pressed to the brink would they actually go to war. That was the security thinking or the public security thinking and the way that they expressed their military doctrine for the first few decades of their existence. And it wasn't until the 1982 war in Lebanon where Prime Minister Begin admitted that this was a war of choice. He said, he has chosen to go in. And so that was made the war very controversial. So it's, again, another tension, as with many things.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the impact of Israel's occupation policies and the militarized responses in the occupied territories with Mira Sukharov of Carleton University, Brent Sasley, the University of Texas Arlington, and Joshua Shaines of the College of Charleston. And Brent Sasley, you know, sort of, you know, following up on this as well, it's kind of this definition of security, this need to respond to show strength. And I know there's been some writing broadly on the need for a kind of muscular Zionism that certainly could be derived from perceptions of weakness and definite trauma of the Jewish nation. So as part of what's going on here is, gender scholars would say, it's this sort of masculinist approach to this need to show strength, and in particular, salient considering the history of the Jewish people.
Yeah, and this gets back to what Joshua was mentioning before, when the early Zionist leaders and activists were creating the Zionist movement and starting to emigrate to the area. What they were trying to do was create this, quote, new Jew. The idea was that they were creating a whole new identity that would be very different from, as Mira said, the kinds of Jews who had lived in Europe for centuries and let themselves be bullied and persecuted. And then, of course, after the Holocaust, let themselves be led like lambs to the slaughter. And so they really wanted to emphasize this muscular, Max Nordau was the Zionist leader who used the term muscular. I think he used muscular Judaism or muscular Jewry. I forget the exact phrase. But the idea was that this new Jew would come and would be tied to the land, and people who work on the land are muscular, they're healthy, they're hardy. And then that would be reflected in everything that this new entity, whatever it was at that time, it wasn't until much later it was decided that they would pursue a state, but that would be reflected in everything in the state, including its military policy. And that's why after the state is created, Israel's military doctrine is very aggressive. It emphasizes preemptive strikes. It emphasizes carrying the war outside of Israeli territory, because that was perceived as the only way to achieve security. And so, you know, that was the military policy, but that trickles down throughout all of Israeli society. And there's some really interesting literature that talks about militarism in Israel and how that's affected everything from the private sphere, abuse of spouses, to attitudes toward Palestinian citizens of Israel, to the emphasis on the use of force and so on. And I think everything that we see now, that Netanyahu and others have been talking about in terms of deterrence or compellence, I think is a contemporary reflection of all of that. And that's just simply rooted in the Zionist movement.
Perfect spot for transition, Joshua, or at least a slight transition. We've used this phrase Zionism quite a bit, and you had a definition of Zionism. I'd like to spend a little bit of time sort of wrestling with, you know, what exactly do we mean by Zionism? Because there's been this numerous references to, there seems to be at least at some, there's a racial component, there's a security component, there's a status component to it, or at least that's how it gets advanced. So first is a deceptively simple question. What is Zionism?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's not an easy one to answer on one foot or off the cuff. So the term itself was coined in the 1890s by a guy named Nathan Birnbaum. And, you know, the word Zion refers to Jerusalem. He was at that point very focused on Palestine, so he liked that. It was one of the many, many forms of Jewish nationalism that was born at the time. And there are actually many kinds of Zionism. There's socialist Zionism and more right-wing Zionisms, and there's religious Zionisms and all sorts of Zionisms. So the term has evolved over time. What they all share in common, every Zionism sort of believes in this modern idea, which was a revolutionary idea, that Jews constitute a political nation, not a religion and not a people, not an ethnic group, or not only those things in any event, but a political nation. And eventually that would mean they have to have a state. Now, the nature of that state, what kind of economy they would have, what kind of foreign policy, those things were debated, but they all believed that the diaspora, Jews in diaspora, that was somehow defective in some way, Jews had to be gathered to some kind of place as a modern political nation. Now, once you have Israel formed, arguably the meaning of Zionism could change and the way it's used has changed. So for example, one could ask the question, does Zionism mean the way Israel has played out? We say the way Israel's played out, they've become a pretty right-wing place. They've been committed to the occupation of the West Bank and expanding settlements and everything that goes along with that. Do we say that to be a Zionist means to support that? So for example, somebody like Martin Buber, who is this great Jewish philosopher and a Zionist, but was a binationalist. He didn't want a nation state. He wanted a binational state. Do we say that he's not really a Zionist anymore because his vision has been cast aside? And I can't really tell anybody what to think about that, but it's something to think about, what it means. People use it in different ways. And I think if people are having conversation, it's very useful to interrogate what the person means by it. Very often when a person in the diaspora especially says, I'm a Zionist, what they really mean is I have an emotional connection to Israel, or maybe they just even mean I have Jewish pride. And I don't necessarily support anything happening in Israel, but I have Jewish pride and I'm glad there's an Israel and I'm sort of on their side. Or it can mean a religious Zionist who is absolutely committed to achieving messianic redemption through the redemption of the land and everything in between. And I think it's very important to keep in mind that there are so many different ways to understand the term. And this will become important when we segue at some point, I imagine, in the conversation to the connection between Zionism and anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. What one means by these terms will make all the difference.
Mayor Sukroff, your response?
I'm working on a book now called How to Talk About Zionism, because I think our everyday conversations, particularly on social media, are becoming less and less helpful for, as Josh said, people don't always use the term in the same way. They don't always understand what others mean by it. And sometimes I find it helpful just to leave out the term Zionism or anti-Zionism or non-Zionism altogether. But I do think we need a better way of thinking about it. And one thing I'm going to write about in my book here, I'll float it out here for your listeners, see what kind of reaction I get, is that, as Josh said, Zionism is one of the things he said is it often means an emotional attachment to Israel. And I think that's very common. It also, of course, means the historical political program of creating the state. But the other thing it means, and I think this is what people don't realize often enough, is that today it also means a current governing ideology, a current system of governance in an existing state called Israel that effectively, whether in intent or not, and I think there is a lot of intent to it, but more importantly, effectively privileges Jewish citizens at the expense of non-Jewish citizens and the non-Jewish residents of the West Bank and Gaza. And this is almost so obvious as to not need stating, but I think not enough people really realize that. And that's, I think, where the productive and painful debates are.
And Brent Sasley, I imagine this question about Zionism and Zionism as an identity for the Jewish people has certainly now been tied up in larger questions about nationalism, a kind of muscular nationalism, and you know, and even a kind of an ethnocentric nationalism that frankly we're seeing taking place all over the world, in particular in the West. How much have the recent trends towards nationalism complicated this definition of Zionism?
So I think it does matter that we're seeing these global trends, but just connecting to that, and before I get directly to that, I just wanted to add that, you know, the idea that Zionism was this national liberation movement of the Jewish people, like many other, it drew especially on Eastern European nationalisms. Now that there is a state, the question is, what happens to that Zionism? If it was all about trying to achieve something and then you've achieved it, what happens to it then? And I think that there are discussions, as the other guests have said, about what Zionism actually means, and it would be defined differently in Israel than in outside of Israel. But at least some people have helped morph it from a national movement for independence to some form of patriotism or some sense of nationalism. And I think that Mira's right that the way that it's been used in forming the state has been it's been very explicit about it, privileging Jews over non-Jews in the state. But I think that that's become hardened by the dominance of the political right, which has no interest in diluting that understanding of nationalism. But I think it's also important to put this in a broader perspective, which is what you had mentioned, Doug, that we have seen a trend, an overall trend toward a more kind of ethno-national, right-wing political and cultural movement and sort of sense of nationalism. We've seen that across Europe. We've seen it in America. we saw echoes, we've seen echoes of it in Canada and in Australia. This is part, I mean, I think we can usefully compare it to these other movements. Obviously in Israel, there are particular circumstances, but this in itself is not a brand new thing. I think though, as the others have said, is the way that people are struggling with it is because for so long, the Jews, if we're talking about Jews outside of Israel, for so long, Jews have felt marginalized and excluded. So if they have a state now, and the state is doing things in the name of Zionism that are not very nice, or they're violent, or they're offensive, they're prejudicial, how do you continue to relate to that kind of, to a movement or to an idea or to an ideology that continues to espouse that after having made Zionism so important to your own communal identity? And I think that's where the painful debates are, that, or some of the painful debates that Mira referenced.
When we come back, resolving conflict requires criticism, but criticism of Israel's policies sometimes mix with anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism. How can these be separated from criticism of the government's policies and actions? Stay with us. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The challenges between Israel and Palestine continue despite the ceasefire. Among the very real security and human rights issues is another fundamental issue of how to separate criticism from anti-Semitism. Doug Becker explores this issue and more.
I'm Doug Becker. To kind of shift gears a little bit, Mira Sukharov, one of the things that I find particularly fascinating then is the way in which this broad question of Zionism and Jewish identity ties to Israel. And so explicitly, I suppose, that there's a large Jewish population that's not in Israel. So first, how much is the state of Israel an essential component of Jewish identity worldwide? And then I guess, secondly, where I'm going with all of this is how much does critique of Israeli policies at least become an invitation for anti-Semitism?
I think those are two separate questions, although they have some important what I want to say is those are, of course, two distinct questions, and the way one answers it will partly depend on one's political impulses, but I'll try to lay out the landscape. So in the first part, roughly half the world's Jews are in Israel and half are not, and with the bulk of non-Israeli Jews being in the US, of course. There is, fortunately for social scientists, we have good survey data, and a Pew survey of Jewish Americans just came out again last month, about 7 years after the most recent one. And it shows, I don't have the numbers right in front of me right now, maybe someone else can pull them up while I'm talking, but I could come back to it, but a solid majority, more maybe two-thirds, about a good solid majority of American Jews would say that they do feel a connection to Israel. They feel some sense of attachment to Israel. Now, what that means politically is not really probed and asked on the Pew survey. And that's where I think we need to understand, what does attachment mean? Like someone like me, just speaking personally, I'm very, very, very attached to Israel, but I'm also very, very, very critical of Israel. So sometimes those two positions can coexist in a single person as well. And for me, I could say that poses an internal conflict and it poses a bit of some emotional dissonance, but I would say it doesn't pose, it doesn't actually pose cognitive dissonance, because through that sense of attachment, I feel invested and wanna make change from my perch here in North America, for what it's worth. So that's on the question of attachment. And then on the question of anti-Semitism. Now, of course, some anti-Semites will use Israel's actions as a tool for delivering their hateful messages to Jews. And of course, nothing just to fight anti-Semitism, which goes without saying. But what we'll see is they'll use Israel as one of many tools in their toolbox. If Israel didn't exist, they would have other ways of expressing. They would search hateful people, find ways of expressing their hate. But the other thing is that I think Jews here are struggling with is that Israel does often claim to speak in the name of Jews when there are major anti-Semitic incidents, as there were a few years ago in France. Prime Minister Netanyahu spoke to French Jews and said, your home is here, your home is in Israel. And so the Israeli government wants to position themselves as a voice for Jews. There's also very complex institutional relationships regarding the Jewish agency and how funding happens and American worldwide diaspora Jewish trips like Birthright, and how there's a lot of diaspora and Israel financial relationships that are probably too much in the weeds to go into. But Israel does claim to speak in the name of Jews. Many Jews feel their identities tied up with Israel, but many Jews don't, and nothing excuses anti-Semitism. That's my takeaway there.
And Joshua Shane, she had a response to that as well.
To build on it, I agree with everything she said. We sort of know what anti-Semitism is. Scholars know what this is. It's anti-Semitism is a you have medieval anti-Jewish animosities with sort of medieval Christian ideas about Jews. False ideas that Jews kill Christians for their blood or poison wells and things like this. And then you have modern ideas about a Jewish collective conspiracy to take over the world, to control the banks, to undermine national sovereignty, all of them built on the idea of Jews constituting some kind of single ontological collective with either a billionaire at the head or something like that. And when we see those myths applied in any way, including whether it's Rothschild, who's the puppet master controlling this conspiracy, or George Soros, or the State of Israel, or Zionists, right? All of those are anti-Semitic ideas. And when you see them, they need to be called out. And certainly when people, as Mira said, when people target Jews just because they're Jews as being responsible for Israel's, unfortunately, it's been happening the last couple of weeks in America and Europe, that's anti-Semitism. I mean, violence, of course, and vandalism is always to be condemned, but it's specifically the hate crime of anti-Semitism when it's done in that way. But what I want to emphasize is that not only is criticizing Israel not anti-Semitic, but what's going on is an effort by the political right in Israel, starting with Netanyahu, with allies like Viktor Orban, with allies in America like John Hagee, the head of the Christians United for Israel, who want to redefine anti-Semitism not only as being anti-Zionism, but specifically as being anti their kind of Zionism, which is this right-wing Zionism, very concerned with keeping the West Bank, very concerned with supporting settlements and so on. And so what happens is somebody could be overtly anti-Semitic, I mean, truly express classic anti-Semitic ideas like Viktor Orban and Hungary. But if you support Netanyahu and you support the settlements in the West Bank and you support Greater Israel and you hate Palestinians, you're in good standing. You're fine. Or you could be somebody who's a Jewish or an ally of the Jews. You have no anti-Semitism, but you oppose that Zionist vision. You might even be a Zionist, by the way. You might even be a very strong Zionist, but you oppose that kind of Zionism. That then gets equated with anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. So that's how you get someone like David Friedman, the former ambassador to Israel under Trump, who calls J Street, which is a pretty center-left, moderate, pro-Zionist group, but opposed to AIPAC. They feel AIPAC is too right-wing, so they're more strenuously for two states than they feel AIPAC is. And they get called anti-Semitic, and they even get called by the epithet Kapo, which is using something from the Holocaust, a truly offensive term. And so I think we need to be aware of how anti-Semitism, what it actually is, and how it mixes with anti-Zionism. And if I may, there've been some attempts to do that. And my article that you mentioned talks about one recent attempt, which everyone can look up on their own. It's called the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, or JerusalemDeclaration.org. And they try to play that balance. They try to say, this is anti-Semitism. When it is applying any of these myths of Jews to Israel or Zionists or anything like that, that is anti-Semitism. But simply criticizing Israel, protesting Israel, even boycotting Israel, that is not anti-Semitic on its face. So I think that's the distinction we have to make. And it's a real threat to people like Netanyahu, who want to, they really, it's in their interest, it's in the interest of anti-Zionists and of very right-wing Zionists to obfuscate the distinction between the West Bank and Israel proper, because they both want it to be one thing, whereas people who are Zionist and centrist want to emphasize the distinction between those territories, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, because you're actually kind of raising an interesting question here about sort of, you know, operating on two different levels. The first is criticism of Israel or support for certain policies, boycott, et cetera. Does that make you anti-Semitic? The second is, are there ways in which people who are demonstrating some anti-Semitism can blunt that criticism because of support for Israeli policies? Mira Sukharov.
Just a point of information to help your listeners contextualize this new Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism that I was a signatory to as well. And that declaration, that attempt to create a more productive definition in the eyes of the signatories and drafters, is a response to what some of your listeners will already have heard about, and that is the IHRA definition. And that is the common definition now that the US State Department, I believe, has adopted, elements in Canada have adopted. There are debates right now in faculty associations whether to adopt it or not. And there's a lot of controversy around it because it does, in the eyes of its critics, the IHRA definition conflates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And maybe even in the eyes of its supporters, and that I'm not sure, maybe Josh has a better handle on that. Do you think its supporters would agree that the IHRA definition tries to make an anti-Zionist utterance anti-Semitic?
I would say, if I just to jump in, I would say that many of the supporters, if not most of the supporters, they themselves think that anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism, but they may also say IHRA doesn't insist on it. I think that the critique of IHRA is that it's not, because of the way it's written, that in practice it's used in ways that shut down criticism of Israel, that shut down Palestinian advocacy and so on, even if its well-intentioned authors didn't want that, even if they claim they don't want that, but in practice that happens. I don't think it's a coincidence that happens when so many of the people themselves equate anti-Zionism in the broadest sense with anti-Semitism. But I think that's the critique, to be a little more specific, that it's too open to abuse, I think, is the problem, which is why, as you know, that the principal author of that definition, Ken Stern, who stands behind it to this day, who likes the definition for what he intended it to collect data, and he says it's perfectly good for that. You want to have a wide as net as possible to collect data, just not to legislate. You don't want a wide, broad net to legislate. You want something that's far more specific to legislate, or not to legislate at all would be his preference, and mine as well, for that matter.
And he's worried about academic freedom in universe higher education settings being infringed.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
One thing to also just notice is supporters of Israel will often say, and here's a word, every group, kind of political group, has their code words. When you hear the word policies, as in Israeli policies, chances are, unless it's a political science foreign policy course in a university, and you know, Brent and I teach this, we talk a lot about policies, but in day-to-day discourse, Brent, tell me if you agree in terms of the day-to-day travels that you go in. If you hear the word Israeli policies, chances are that is being uttered by a supporter of Israel. And I'm making a big kind of grand claim just to be a bit provocative, because intense critics of Israel will now say, you'll hear them say, well, you won't hear them say, but what they mean is this goes beyond policies. This isn't about specific policy. This is about the overall governing structure of Israel, the overall regime, the overall state ethos. And so why am I saying this? Supporters of the IHRA definition will say, oh, you can criticize Israeli policies all you want, as long as ... Whereas critics of Israel are now saying that isn't enough.
Yeah, Brent, you were
talking. Yeah, I'm not sure. That's interesting. I'd have to think about it more. I do think that we are seeing more and I'm putting it in air quotes, pro-Israel, because, you know, we could talk about what pro-Israel means or what pro-Palestinian means. I actually think those are unhelpful terms, but generally speaking, it's understood that pro-Israel means you are a defender of contemporary Israel and what the government does. I think that you're right that many pro-Israel people now assume that any criticism of Israel or Israeli policy is a criticism of Israel itself, its raison d'etre, its, you know, its effort to be a place for Jews to become a quote-unquote normal nation, which is what early Zionist leaders wanted. I think that that's true. I'd have to think more about the other aspect too, the policy aspect. But I did just want to add also, I mean, you know, Mira and Joshua were talking about the problems of legislating anti-Semitism definition. We're seeing what that looks like in practice now as state legislatures in the United States have legislated not being anti-Zionist. So, you know, the state will not do business with, some states like in Texas will not do business with companies that support a boycott of Israel. And they don't distinguish when they say boycott of Israel, they don't necessarily distinguish between Israel within the Green Line and Israel in the West Bank. So if a company wanted to boycott products from Israeli settlements in the West Bank, the state of Texas won't do business with them according to this new law. And so this is why, you know, it's become politicized how you define anti-Semitism and where anti-Zionism fits in there. And there are real world consequences to it in this context, because people are legislating those kinds of things and imposing those definitions on private companies and on individuals.
Yes, and Joshua Shane, the IHRA definition is something that my understanding is that there's legislation drawn up nationally at the U.S. Congress to adopt that as the definition of anti-Semitism. Is that correct?
There's been states who have done it. The best of my knowledge, Congress has not passed anything yet based on it. There is the executive order that Trump issued in 2019, which myself and others wrote articles explaining the problems with it. That is still on the books. President Biden has not overturned that. In fact, he just met this week with some leaders, and out of the news reports from those meetings suggested he was not going to overturn that. So that is still on the books, and that does have issues that Brunt raised. I know that a lot of, you know, ACLU raises issues of freedom of expression and belief, but also because of the issue of the settlements, right? We have this weird situation. I mean, the settlements are illegal under international law. The United States, with the exception of a brief period in the Trump administration, the United States holds those to be illegal. And yet it becomes illegal to respond by not buying their products. And that's a bizarro world we find ourselves in. It's the same bizarro sort of conundrum of the West Bank itself, right? If the West Bank is an occupied territory, which it is, but if it's that, then civilian settlements become illegal because of the Geneva Convention. Now, if the West Bank is part of Israel, as the Israeli right says, and as Texas apparently says, and others say, then why aren't the Palestinians their citizens? And if they're not, then you have the A word, right? And that's sort of the conundrum. Either it's Israel or it's not. But somehow it's in the in-between world. It is Israel in the sense that you can have Jewish settlements there, but it's not Israel in the sense that we cannot give the Palestinians equality and still call ourselves a democracy. And that's sort of that weird, you know, in between we find ourselves in now. And if I may pivot for a moment, I think this relates to the bigger question we're getting at of the problem of Jewish identity in connection to Israel, right? Because for so many years, my whole childhood, for sure, I grew up in the 70s and 80s in America in a very Zionist home, a very Zionist Jewish day school. We didn't have to think about, I don't know if we didn't have to, but we didn't think about Palestinians at all. We didn't think about one state or two states. We didn't think about Palestinian equality. They just weren't on the map. It wasn't an issue we thought about. Then as people begin to think about the Palestinians and the problem of Palestinians, so then two-state solution, which was once very radical and considered anti-Zionist and dangerous, becomes normative by the 90s, say. That's going to be the solution, that we can have a Jewish democratic Israel, but also Palestinian rights. And that's developing, but then festering to the extent that, as Mira mentioned with Lustig's book, The Paradigm Lost, where you have effectively a one-state reality now, where the West Bank, if you visit the West Bank and you're Jewish, it feels like it's part of Israel. You don't even notice the Green Line anymore. They don't even put it on the map sometimes. And so we're at a new stage in Jewish diaspora identity where we still feel this deep connection to Israel, which like Mira, I feel very much. I'm there all the time. I used to live there and I'm connected to them. But also this problem that we really do think about Palestinians and Palestinian rights, and we don't really see a way out of it. And that's a new situation that's changing the game to an extent. What do we do about that? And, you know, it depends how you understand what it means to be a Zionist and what it means to be pro-Israel. I'm with Brent. I think terms like pro-Israel, I think they're pretty problematic and counterproductive. It might be best to avoid them altogether.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing Israeli identity, Jewish identity, and Israeli occupation policies, discriminatory policies with Mira Sukharov of Carleton University, Brent Sasley of the University of Texas Arlington, and Joshua Shaines of the College of Charleston. And I'm going to use your comments there, Joshua, to sort of bring us to kind of a last main topic, and that is ultimately how much the occupation, the impact it has broadly on Israel's commitment to democracy and to human rights. Now, ask Mira Sukharov, I'll ask you this first. It seems to me that there's really only three options that the Israelis have. One is decidedly undemocratic, which would be a one-state solution, but not granting Palestinians full, you know, equal rights. One would be a human rights disaster, which would be some form of ethnic cleansing of Palestinian populations out of the territory, or a fully democratic binational state. Of course, the fourth option would be a two-state solution. Can Israel adopt a one-state solution without losing its democratic and its human rights supportive identities that have heretofore, you know, helped to describe the state of Israel?
So let's use Iron Lustig's framing and say that Josh just echoed, and say that there is a one-state reality, that Israel is the effective ruling power to large extent between the river and the sea. And so the question is, who has rights and who doesn't? What is Israel willing to do to extend rights? So your question was, if Israel did extend rights, full equality to all residents, to all individuals between the river and the sea, would it stave off its humanitarian disaster? It would. But then the question that Israeli Jews, I think, are worried about is, would Israeli Jewish safety and cultural flourishing be ensured? I think that's probably the question that goes along with that. And I just founded a group, Josh helped me draft the principles called Drachim, if any of your listeners are interested in it. Brent's in it too, as well. And we're calling for full equality going forward in a reimagined polity that does support the flourishing of two national groups side by each with some synergies, where one group doesn't culturally assimilate the other. But I want to actually pose one little small conundrum, and I wonder if my very smart and knowledgeable colleagues can help me through this. If Israel were to grant citizenship, so full equality, including citizenship, to all the Palestinians between the river and the sea, they would have to first annex the West Bank. But annexation is illegal under international law. Annexation of territories acquired through war, as the West Bank was for Israel in 67. So not that Israel is in any way interested right now in extending equality, but if they were, does that kind of little legal blip put Israel between a rock and a hard place?
Right. Well, I think it does, but I can say that for the political right, it's not a problem, because some on the political right don't think that the population of Arabs or Palestinians between the river and the sea is actually much less than what people say it is. So they really don't think that it would be a problem. Others think that you can others on the right think that you can have them incorporated into Israel, but they can have citizenship elsewhere, usually in Jordan. And then still others, and some on the far religious right segment of the political spectrum, don't care whether or not they have, whether it doesn't matter how many of them are there. They're not Jews. They don't deserve to be part of the Jewish polity. And so if they're going to stay there, well, you know, they can't be equal. And they don't have a problem with that. They don't see that as a bad thing. And I think that that's an evolution of sorts for that segment of the political right. But other than that, I mean, we have had prime ministers, former prime ministers talk about Israel potentially becoming an apartheid state if it doesn't change policy. And so Ehud Barak mentioned, he used that word explicitly. Others like Ariel Sharon, you know, a pretty firm right winger, suggested that there needs to be some complete separation between Israel and the Palestinians and the West Bank and Gaza. So they do see that there's something there. And I think it's probably fair to say that most Israelis, if they really think about it, view it as being in a rock and a hard place. But I don't think most Israelis think about it. I just don't, in the same way that prior to the first Intifada, there was no most Israeli Jews did not see there being any kind of line between Israel and the Gaza Strip or the West Bank. I think similarly, we see that the occupation is just not something that they think about. They don't see many settlements as being settlements. They don't see that there's a difference between the two areas. They just don't conceive of it. It's blurred culturally, politically, economically, socially. And so it's just not something that they're worried about.
So, but annexing the territory, formally annexing it as a precursor to giving full citizenship, I mean, if and when, this is obviously talking in a very idealistic sense, but if they were to annex the territory, that wouldn't create international opprobrium criticism based on the fact that that in and of itself would be contrary to international law?
The view from outside, just kind of the general sort of legal view, I think a lot of that would probably have to do with whether or not the Palestinian Authority were to consent to it. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, whether or not it's illegal is at least in part almost assuredly going to be a Security Council question for the UN or, you know, for the ICJ. But if the Palestinian Authority were to view this as an opportunity and say, we would consent to this because it results in a one-state solution, I don't think it would be illegal. But if they did not, I think you're right that they would run into quite a bit of a legal challenge.
Yeah, good point. The Palestinian Authority, of course, suffers from a huge legitimacy crisis within its people. So if they were to consent to something that the people didn't have buy-in for, that could cause a huge political problem. But I get your point legally.
I was just going to add that I don't remember the most recent public opinion surveys, but surveys show that Israeli Jews tend to be, they don't support annexing the entire West Bank. It depends how you ask the question. They're okay with annexing some of it. So again, I'm not sure that they think that there's a problem or that there's a problem on the horizon. And I think that that obviously is detrimental to good public policy, but I'm just not sure that it's for most Israeli Jews, it's something to worry about.
Joshua Shane, I'm going to give you the last word.
Yeah. So first of all, I couldn't agree more with Brent, right? When things are quiet for Jews, they don't think about the West Bank and the fact that you have millions of people under occupation. By the way, there was a great article in the Times just detailing what it means to live under occupation in the West Bank for the Palestinians. Jews don't feel it. They don't, except when there's tension or war like we just had, then all of a sudden, well, we can't leave now because you see they're a threat. And otherwise, they're worried about the price of cottage cheese, which was a big protest movement a few years ago. So I think that's part of the problem. Israel doesn't have to annex the West Bank formally. They've already annexed it. It's already done. The West Bank is annexed. It's part of Israel. Anything Israel wants to take, they take and they grow settlements on and they squeeze Palestinians because they don't allow construction. So we have to recognize the reality. And you asked at the beginning, what should be the future? One state, two states, confederation, whatever. You know, anything is theoretically possible, right? You could pick up 500,000 Jews and force them to leave theoretically, but that's not practically possible. But that's not the reality now. Whatever the future brings. The problem with talking about two states is that unless you back it with a recognition of needing to get out of the West Bank and undo the settlements, and also back it with support for pressure to make it happen, the call for two states has served in effect to give cover to continued annexation. Ironically, paradoxically, calling for two states has enabled one state to emerge. Not a democratic state because the Palestinians in the West Bank don't have rights, but one state all the same. It could have been, I don't know, that paradoxically calling for one state would have scared Israel enough to get out of the West Bank and make two states. It's a sort of a paradox. But whatever future we want to achieve for equality, it's not going to work unless we begin with the realization that there is a one-state reality right now, that the West Bank is part of Israel. People worried about apartheid someday. When there were 50,000 Jews in the West Bank, they said, if we get to 100,000, it's too late. That's what the deputy mayor of Jerusalem said at the time. If we get to 100,000, it's too late. We're over 500,000 now, and they're everywhere. So I think we have to be realistic about the situation, and whatever we want to have for the future, base it on that reality. And that's the problem we face right now. It's very scary to say we have one state, because that means it's going to be a binational state. Zionists weren't always so scared of that. You know, before Israel was formed, Zionists assumed it was going to be a binational state. After all, in the UN partition, even the Jewish part of the partition was half Jewish, half Arab. So they assumed there would be a binational state. They had plans for it. Now, what happened during the war, of course, is that hundreds of thousands of Arabs fled. Hundreds of thousands were expelled by the Jewish forces, and they kept them out, and they made a Jewish majority. But they didn't expect that to happen. We know that they didn't expect it to happen. They went with it, and Ben-Gurion sealed the gates of keeping them out, but they didn't expect that. So we have models to think about binationalism, and we have to realize we have a binational reality right now. Right now, half the people controlled by the Israel army are not Jewish, are Arab. And so we have to remember that and think about the future from that standpoint, whatever it may be. Whether we decide to create democracy in a binational state, whether we somehow miraculously make two states or something in between.
I think that's a wonderful point to conclude the conversation with just a quick observation on my part, that since there's been so much concern about security, that democracy, respect for rights, and a binational state that's fully respectful of both nations is, in my mind, the best pathway to a truly secure nation. I want to thank our guests. Our guests today have been Mira Sukharov, Professor of Political Science and University Chair of Teaching Innovation in the Department of Political Science at Carleton University. She's the author of The International Self, Psychoanalysis and the Search for Israeli-Palestinian Peace, and the co-editor of Social Justice in Israel-Palestine, Foundational and Contemporary Debates. Brent Sasley is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Texas Arlington. He's the author of Politics in Israel, Governing a Complex Society, and The End of Oslo and the Second Intifada, 2000 to 2005. And Joshua Chains, who's Associate Professor of Jewish Studies and the Director of the Arnold Center for Israel Studies at the College of Charleston. He's the author of Diaspora Nationalism and Jewish Identity in Habsburg Galicia, and the co-author of We Need a Better Definition of Antisemitism. Thank you all very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.